Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Students around the world are asking questions about God, the truth, and the meaning of their lives. Your gift will put top-notch Catholic intellectuals in front of students who are seeking. Go to ThomisticInstitute.org/support-students to transform a student's life today. That's ThomisticInstitute.org/support-students.
So, Father Gregory, thought I'd give a little bit of an overview of the aspect of anger that I want to focus on, and then kind of stack up some questions that we can then bat around.
Perfect.
I'm good? And for those of you who are just witnessing all this, the intended outline, whether we depart from it or not, is on the board behind us. So first, this talk or conversation is going to look at the work of anger, not just within an individual human being, but rather in human community. I think it's always worth asking whether the talk is worth having first. So the reason why I think that this is worth discussing is that, if you recall, anger has, you could almost say it has dynamism that's threefold. Anger is always at someone on account of something that I have suffered and for the sake of the restoration of justice. So that's a kind of confusing dynamism, but it helps to think of it, at least I like to think of it loosely, as anger has something to do with the past, namely an offense has been committed, even if that sting is still being felt in the present. So it has that on account of something that I've suffered. It also has a present dimension, which is I am angry at the cause of that injustice. And that cause is still somehow present to me, whether in my imagination or right physically in front of me. And then it also has a future directedness, and that the reason why I'm angry at you is because I seek to restore justice for some future good. So of those three dimensions, it seems to me like we can easily overlook the at dimension, and we can also overlook the for the sake of which dimension. This isn't always the case, but it seems to me like when we get angry, we can either just be really caught up in the sensation of being angry, whether because it makes me feel like I have a purpose or because it's just pleasant. So I can focus on the sensation of being angry and have no more reflection on it. Or if I do reflect on my anger, most often, I think our attention is directed to the on account of which am I angry. And what I mean by this is something like this. We tend to think, I'm not saying that this is a good tending, but we tend to think that our anger is unjustified, or rather we tend to think that I shouldn't be angry in this situation. And in order to make sense of the fact that I am angry, but I shouldn't be angry, I try to kind of whittle away at my perception of the offense. So I might say something like this: oh, come on, is it really that bad? Is it really worth your attention? Shouldn't you just direct your attention elsewhere? So that sort of self-talk, or maybe you're talking with a friend, is intended to minimize the sting of the offense. Whether it's, you know, that minimization is true to life or not, we tend to go in that direction. We also might tend to say, okay, yeah, it really was an offense and it really did hurt, but we might then try to excuse the person who did it. So we might find a reason why it wasn't so vile on his part. We might say, oh, he was tired. Or we might even try to find a reason why we think it was justified, got hurt. And in those cases, again, I'm trying to minimize the felt sense of injustice. So it seems to me like in ordinary living, we focus on the on account of which aspect of anger. So I'd like to give a little bit of space, time to the consideration of the person at whom I'm angry, and then also consideration of the for what am I seeking the restoration of justice? All right. Moving on to just an overview of the at aspect of anger. Thomas is very clear that if I'm angry, then there's always some sort of directionality to that anger. That's to say, if I am angry, I am always angry at someone. And that doesn't seem to square with our experience all the time, because suppose you're on the phone with American Airlines trying to get a flight change, trying to get a refund because your flight was delayed 18 hours or something like along those lines, and you get directed to a machine and you try to scream at the machine and it directs you to another part of the machine. Most of us would not deny that we're angry, and we might try to take our anger out on either the phone or the cat. Or the next passerby. In all those cases, even when we can't identify exactly who is the cause of our present affliction, we nonetheless direct our anger at some unknown cause. And Thomas doesn't deny the fact that we can get angry at inanimate objects or at animals, but he says we only do so when we regard that inanimate object or that animal as capable of slighting us intentionally. So there's a kind of a mental trick that he doesn't say. We don't really get angry, but if we do, this is what's happening. So we always have someone or something at whom we are angry. I think it's helpful to consider there's a paradigm case of anger being directed at someone, and to give James and John, the Son of Thunder, a little bit of a break, or at least have a different example in the other talk. Take Brutus and Popeye. So this is going to be the paradigm case. And then I'm going to give a few tweaks that I think are interesting. So the paradigm case of being angry at someone is Brutus and Popeye, who roughly speaking are peers, at least socially they're peers. Whether morally they're peers is a question, but say they're socially they're peers. What that means relationally is...
I haven't watched Popeye in a long time. Who's Brutus?
Oh, man. Okay, Brutus is the one that looks a lot stronger than Popeye and always seems to get what Popeye wants until Popeye eats spinach.
Yeah.
Or, according to the 1937 version of this cartoon, Popeye rubbed the head of Bernice, which is a special hen, and in the process of rubbing Bernice's head, got these superpowers.
Okay.
But apparently that didn't fly as much as eating spinach.
Okay.
So anyhow, okay, so Brutus and Popeye, friends. Brutus looks physically like he's superior to Popeye, but that's kind of the constant question. It's really who's stronger. Who is it that is going to win the affection of olive oil? All right, so to say that Brutus and Popeye or anyone else are peers, relationally speaking, this means that Brutus owes to Popeye the same thing that Popeye owes to Brutus. So there's no inequality on that level. Okay, so this is the paradigm case. Suppose Brutus walks into the room and Popeye greets Brutus, but Brutus does not return the greeting. There's an offense. Suppose that Popeye judges, whether he's right or not, he judges that Brutus did this first deliberately, and that's to say he had the opportunity either to return the greeting or not. So Brutus isn't deaf in this situation. So Popeye judges that Brutus did it deliberately, but also that Brutus did it as a slight. In other words, Brutus didn't do it because he was lazy, didn't want to speak that day, but he did it intending to hurt Popeye. That's a paradigm case in which Popeye would be angry at Brutus. Again, it's intentional and it's done out of malice. And their peers. So it seems like if we tweak some of the aspects of Brutus, we can decrease Popeye's anger. So suppose, let's start with increasing. Suppose Brutus is Popeye's employee. Brutus walks into the room, Popeye greets him, Brutus doesn't return the greeting. The anger will be greater in this circumstance because the distance between Brutus and Popeye is greater. Okay, it can also be increased. We can increase Popeye's anger if Brutus has long been plotting how to hurt Popeye. Maybe this is the 17th time he's done it, and it works every time. So that can increase Popeye's anger, because this is increasing the intentionality or even increasing the malice of it. We can also tweak some things about Brutus that will decrease Popeye's anger at him. One, perhaps Brutus is Popeye's boss. So here, what Brutus owes to Popeye doesn't seem like it's as much as what he would owe to him if they were just peers, or if Brutus was his inferior. Popeye's anger would either be less or completely non-existent if Brutus was deaf. Perhaps, again, Brutus isn't deaf, but he's really tired, and evidently so. In that case, Popeye would judge, okay, it wasn't intended as a personal slight, even if it wasn't very nice not to be greeted. So that's a little bit about the at aspect of anger and how it can either amplify or decrease or even dissipate entirely anger. The for aspect of anger is something along these lines. If I'm angry, then I desire to punish someone for the sake of rectification of justice. If you don't have this for piece at all, in other words, if you're not seeking punishment for the sake of some good, then either you have just sheer hatred, or, here's kind of an aside, I wonder if you might have sorrow that's trying to kind of inch its way along into anger, just because being sad, is in some respects harder and not as gratifying as being angry. So here's my weird scenario that is just as a comparison against anger. Suppose I'm sad because I realize I'm not very smart, and I don't want to be sad. So what I do is I look around for someone to blame for my stupidity, to blame for my suffering. So I look around and I spy Susie, who's pretty smart. And I imagine somehow that my intellect is dull because Susie's is really sharp. In this way, I can direct my anger at Susie on the false premise that making her suffer will somehow eliminate my sorrow. It's kind of strange because even though making Susie suffer isn't going to make me any smarter, it might make the burden of bearing with my own stupidity just a little easier. So I put that as this sorrow masquerading as anger, as, I don't know, maybe, I don't think it's really anger in that case. But that's a situation where I'm seeking rectification of justice, really for, not as a good, but as a good that's merely trying to alleviate me from some other evil. Back to more standard cases. We can desire rectification of justice for different reasons. And I have four here. Popeye can desire rectification of justice, which we can just say he wants to be acknowledged. Why does he want to be acknowledged? Well, he can want to be acknowledged, Brutus, for his own sake. Namely, he wants to be acknowledged so that he can assume his rightful agency in the community. So if he gets used to not being acknowledged at all, and everyone else gets used to that, then Popeye won't ever have a voice. That's not good. So Popeye wants his voice for his sake. That's one reason why we can seek rectification of justice. Popeye might also say, I want justice, in other words, I want to be acknowledged for Brutus's sake. And that would go something like this. Popeye wants Brutus to be forced to recognize Popeye's existence so that Brutus doesn't become someone who is so morally lost that he's incapable of any real relationship. So this is a situation where Popeye might want to right the situation for the sake of the other, even if it didn't redound to any benefit for Popeye himself. Third, Popeye could seek rectification of justice for Brutus and Popeye's sake communally. So not just mine or yours, but ours, for our sake. What this would look like is Popeye wants to be acknowledged, because unless Brutus acknowledges Popeye's agency, then neither of them can enjoy an ordered relationship, or at least a well-ordered relationship. And then lastly, it's kind of a Kantian spin, Popeye could seek, you didn't know that Popeye was a Kantian, right? That's not in the 1937 version. Popeye can seek to rectify justice just for the sake of duty, of justice itself, abstractly considered. And hard to imagine what this would really be like, but I think it's something like this, that he would have to do it really without imagining or wanting either his own good or Brutus's good or the shared good. It's just a sort of wild abstraction that this is something I should do, even if it didn't help me or you or us. So I find these four reasons why we would seek out justice interesting. And here's one reason why. It seems to me like when we, culturally speaking, reflexively regard anger as bad or as not desirable or in some respects not good, I think what we assume is first that Popeye is seeking the rectification of justice for his sake only. That's one assumption. There's, we assume that the reason why I want to, as in the other, you know, situation, reason why I want to body slam John is for my sake, not for his, not for ours, and not for abstract justice. And then I also think that we assume that the value of whatever Popeye would gain from the reestablishment of justice is less than what Brutus would lose by being punished. So I think we make first the assumption that really this is a self-focused act, and then that what I, myself, would gain is not as significant as what Brutus would lose. And that, if that is the reasoning, that I think that makes sense of why we conclude that in most instances, we shouldn't get angry, or in most instances, we should try to distract ourselves or somehow remedy our anger. I also find that this account of the four aspects of anger and those four reasons why we might want rectification of justice, I think this is interesting because it seems like in family units or priories and convents or households, you sometimes, you know, not sometimes, you probably always have a situation where perhaps there's a bit of tension in the community and everyone is partially responsible for that tension. Everyone is partially responsible, but it's easiest to kind of let the steam escape, open up the steam valve, if you kind of take it out on one person, whether you are conscious of doing so or not. This is somewhat of the scapegoat phenomenon. But what's interesting to me is when we can, when we take on kind of the posture of a scapegoat, thinking that it's something good, but really it's not as good for the community as getting angry would be. So let me describe just in general a situation. Suppose there's a family, everyone has issues, but everyone tends to blame the mom. And the mom looks around and says, you know what, just in order to keep the peace, I'll take it on myself. And maybe after time, she even believes that she is the cause of this. And she might say, it's better to keep the peace than for me to get angry and to point out the injustice. So I know that's a really tangled situation, but I also think it's partially true of many situations. Side note, and then I'm almost ready to stop speaking, almost. I think it's really hard to figure out just by sheer introspection what our motives are. Really hard. So I'm not claiming that we can just say, oh, close your eyes and look around in your heart and figure out why you're doing this. I happen to think that the best way to figure out what my motives are is talking with you. But not you, a room full of 60 people, but talking it out with someone who knows me, doesn't really have an agenda in fixing me or not, but can reflect back to me what seems right and what seems wrong. So at least there we have two sets of eyes. Okay, here are some odd cases that I would love to bat around or hear your thoughts on. And each of these odd cases involves a different act. The pattern of my question is the same in all of them. It's this: what is happening when we get angry at, number one, a friend, number two, at myself, and then number three, at God? Each of these scenarios is odd, perhaps not for exactly the same reason, but for similar reasons, which is that a friend, myself, and God all are people who, by definition, love me. And by definition, if the person is a friend, if I am myself one unity, I'm not seeking to slight me. And similarly, I will stretch to say that the definition of God is the one who doesn't want to slight me, but God is good all the time. So how is it that I can somehow direct my anger at God as one who intends my suffering or intends to slight me out of malice? So I think these are odd because they are, in some respects, undeniable in our experience that we do get angry at friends. In fact, maybe we get angriest at the people who are closest to us, who are, in fact, most friendly to us. That seems to be a bit of a paradox, but if we can wrestle with that paradox a little bit, might be able to crack open some of the reasons why we can also get really angry at ourselves and also really angry at God.
Thank you. I have a follow-up thought / proposal that may make sense of some of those intuitions. I suspect that you have a proposal in mind, but I'm going to send mine over the bow and you tell me what you think. So I think, when we talk about justice, we're talking about operation. So we're talking about something that is, typically external to, but it's a virtue. So that signifies that what transpires external to, in upright fashion, ought to be interiorized or internalized in such a way that we ourselves are reconciled to the reality. So that we ourselves, in rectifying the operations, are in turn rectified. And I think part of the interiorization of the rectification of those operations. Yeah, let's go. Sweet Latinic roots. I feel like I need to say a bunch of Anglo-Saxon words in order to atone for such thing.
I feel like you need a diagram.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so there are things going on out there. We're trying to make good on them. And in doing so, we become the type of people who make good on them. So we interiorize what exteriorly is a matter of, taking care of those for whom we're responsible. And I think that when you combine this just simple picture with a pre-Enlightenment idea of what it means to be a human, which involves a high degree of relatedness, like we're born into relationships within the setting of a family, within the setting of a polity, within the setting of a church, we're already in a network. We're already in a series of relationships which we're meant to rectify here, but are supposed to resonate in here. And so in putting that in conversation with what St. Thomas says about slighting another, I think that we're meant to hold the other in mind and in heart. And the other is supposed to have some modicum of certainty and confidence that she is held in mind and in heart. And I think what we ultimately find angry is the manifestation or communication that I am not held in mind and in heart, or that I am not held in mind and heart in a way that could be aptly described as just. And here we probably end up mixing a little bit with love, or, we even get into charity in Christian settings. That's just a simple proposal. What do you think of that?
Yeah. To the phrase held in mind and heart, I was thinking about what would a very young child's sense of justice be? I'm not talking about you took a piece of pie or, you took more than your fair share. I'm saying, what does it, interiorly, how does injustice register? It seems to me like it's something like this. There's something good out there that I want and I'm not getting it. That's very, very basic. But I think our first incipient notion of justice is something like that. There's something good that's actually meant for me. Like, I'm meant for it, and it's meant for me, and I'm not getting it. And that cry, you know, it's painful, that cry of that's not fair, I think is this first sense of injustice. What would help if in the moment where I recognize, there's something out there that's meant for me, and I'm meant for it, and I'm not getting it, if there was someone else nearby that could actually affirm my goodness and the fact that, yes, I am made for that thing, and that thing is made for you, and it hurts. So for you to hold me in mind and heart, I'm thinking this just on the, how does this register to those who can't yet read, mm-hmm. you know, and who can say fair but not justice, let alone any of those Anglo-Saxon words. The sense of being held in mind and heart is something like this, that you desire for me what I desire for myself. And you desire it as much or even more than I desire it for myself. So for you to hold me in mind and heart means for you to be aware of what is good for me and for you actually to desire it.
I think too that have you done much, Ivan, much reading with like attachment theory? Okay. As I understand it, it's like a child has to have the kind of basic existential confidence that often enough its mother is there for it, which provides the basis of a secure attachment, on which basis you can then explore and take risks and experiment with, again, the certainty and the confidence that you can return to this basis and always have it. Like, it's just mm-hmm. rock bottom,
yep.
In a good sense, rock bottom. it's the ground floor of affection. Whereas if you don't have that certainty and confidence for reasons either ambivalent or ambiguous, then it causes a kind of turmoil whereby you're always trying to do the calculus of whether or not there is somebody who can bear it, like whether or not these things are for me, whether or not there is somebody who can provide them, and whether or not there is some way in which to verify. And I think that's like part of the volatility of anger, is that it arises from this insecurity. Because I'm just going to finish the thought.
Yeah, please do.
Part of it is like, part of the reason for which it becomes difficult to express anger in a way that's constructive is like you were saying this point about that the good that I will gain from it will actually be negligible by comparison to the injury that is suffered. Because effectively what I want is to be loved. But if I express my anger to another, how can I ensure that my expression of anger will actually conduce to the love which I in fact treasure? Because given our, you know, kind of corporate insecurity, it's more likely to cause further alienation. So maybe I can just auto-culpabilize, take this upon myself, and hope that in some way, shape, or form, I will find love in the end, which it sounds like that was like your tendency in describing ways in which you can bring it back to yourself or find ways in which to refer it to yourself.
Mm-hmm. With a huge caveat that I don't really know what I'm talking about. It seems to me, going back to secure attachment and avoidant and ambivalent, seems to me like if we're talking about anger as something that is just ontologically good, it's there for our survival and our thriving, even though it's capable of going astray, at root, it is the defense of our good, basically the defense of our desire. I think armor bearer of desire is that what Gregory calls it?
No idea.
Okay. Seems to me like the child, the person who is securely attached, and by that I mean someone who looks at the world and says, this is good, and it's made for me, and I'm made for it. The person who can look into the eyes of another and see that other person affirm that. So the other person, so you look at me and you say, you are good, and that means that this good thing is good for you. That is good. So you confirm and affirm my desires and my essential goodness. I think that person is the most capable of anger, more capable of anger than the one who doesn't have that, for different reasons. And it's something like this, because I think when you look at me and say, you are good, and that good thing is good for you. What that does is it says the justice that you desire is worth desiring. Don't let go of that. Your desire for the world to be right is good. Stand on that. So it does become a ground on which I can judge injustice rightly. But take the example where I want something and I don't get it. But the fact that I don't get it makes me start to second guess my own goodness. Suppose no one is around to correct that. So I end up just being confused about whether I'm good or not. I'm confused about whether I deserve things, even things that are objectively speaking good for me. It's as though I don't have a ground on which to stand, where I can point to something and say with confidence, that's wrong and it shouldn't happen. And then somewhat similarly, suppose in response to this confusion, rather than looking around and trying to find different platforms on which to stand, I just turn to myself. So I say, you know what? No one is going to look at me and tell me that I'm good. So I'm just going to find some other reasoning. I'm going to turn inward. I'm going to become independent. And I'm just going to be the judge of what I need to do. Or I'm just going to avoid everyone and try to remove myself from all situations where it might be unjust. And instead, just avoid the question altogether. In that case, it's almost as though you're taking yourself out of this community in which justice is possible. So it seems to me like someone who is avoidant or ambivalently attached would not be capable of having what maybe we could call constructive anger.
So to bring that in conversation with, you made reference to the question in the Prima Secunda where St. Thomas talks about the remedies of sorrow. And he lists a variety of things, some of which are in deference to the tradition, like taking of baths. But he has a kind of hierarchical order, which you can see bears an anthropology. So it's like the contemplation of the truth, the company of friends, the experience of pleasure, the shedding of tears, the taking of baths. So there's the sense that like we are made for communion with the Most High God, with each other, in an embodied way, which takes account of all of it, right? And I think that while it's going to look a little bit different with anger, that we can propose similar remedies for anger with it, which I think puts us in conversation with the point about God. Like, what is it that we're angry about when we're angry with God? So to use my proposal, not that it's necessarily correct, but suppositionally, are we held in mind and heart by God? Can we rely upon God to give us what is good for our flourishing in accord with the relationship preexistent? And then can we look to him for the affirmation that I am good, I am deserving of this good, like all that comes with that exchange in turn? I think that we want to affirm that in the most basic sense, obviously, but sometimes the instrumentality of it is confusing for us because our prudence is limited with respect to God's providence, and we cannot often see the ways in which God in his eternity is tending to us in our temporality. So like as a potential first remedy for anger when it comes to these types of big ticket issues, would there be like the contemplation of the truth? Does it take on a peculiar characteristic for the healing of anger, for the curing of anger, for, you know, a kind of remedy in this way? I don't know what you think.
I think talking about remedies for anger at friends, self, and God is a little premature until we can figure out what's happening here.
Yeah.
Because at least the puzzle that the puzzle I wanted to play with, you are trying to deprive me, is saying, all right, Thomas's definition of anger seems to exclude the possibility that you could be angry at a friend. So what happens there? So let me get my, I'll give my proposal that I think unlocks
two out of three. I'll react strenuously to it.
Okay, very good.
Regardless of what I'm doing.
Thank you, friend.
Mm-hmm.
give me what I deserve. okay, I think it seems like this. When we do get angry at a friend, I think we're angry at that friend insofar as the person is not acting as a friend. So something like this. I expect you to hold me in mind and heart, to desire what I desire when it is my true good. And when you give evidence that it's otherwise, like when you start to be obnoxious or you don't greet me or you don't, this is sounding
good.
You don't bring me flowers. When you don't do what seems like what seems like another self would do.
Yeah.
I get angry at that part of you, and I'm deliberately using the language of part, because I think something similar happens when I'm angry at myself. So when I do get angry at myself, it's not that I'm angry at the whole of me. It's something like this. I get angry at the part of me that is somehow trying to sabotage my good. And that seems to me to be parallel or on parallel with what happens when we get angry with a friend. What I do when I'm angry at a friend is I'm angry at the part of you that is antagonistic to our friendship. But I recognize that that part of you is not the whole of you. So when I get angry at that part of you, what I'm doing is I'm affirming an alliance with the part of you that is my friend. So it's almost like the stronger that alliance is, the stronger the friendship is, almost like the more vehement the anger can be. It's like I want to attack that thing that's trying to destroy such this very good thing. So I think that notion of I get angry at a part of me, and then I get angry at the part of you that is antagonistic or that is slovenly or whatever it is. I think it's not so simple with God. And this is more of a sociological explanation for why we get angry at God. But it's something like this. Why, in spite of knowing that God is good, that he makes all things work together for the good of those who love him, in other words, in spite of believing in faith that providence is real and that it is good for me and for all and for God, why do we get angry at him? I think it ends up being that we live in a mechanized, automaticized,
you got it.
The more impersonal our world is, the harder it is for me to find the agent behind my suffering. And there are situations where no matter how hard I look, I can't find that agent. And yet I want to be rid of this anger because I don't know what to do with it. I feel somehow like I will die if I just sit with this anger. And the one that I can ultimately point the blame at is God. So I say, you knew all this. So even though it's irrational, even though I believe that God isn't intending this as a slight, it's kind of like he's the only one who's big enough and who's obvious enough who does see it all. So there is something irrational about getting angry at God, but it's also something that seems like it's an evident fact of our experience. There.
Perfect. With respect to others and self, before transitioning back to God, I think the point that you raise about that the friend is another self is an important one. So there's this idea that there's a kind of intimacy to friendship, intimacy in the sense of interiority, because what you share with a friend doesn't actually leave you, it abides in you. So there's a kind of parallel experience in parts of self and parts of friend, insofar as unity is the principle of union. And so it's like when you find yourself betrayed by a friend, I forgot, is in fact an indemnification, it's not a justification. That you forgot means that you weren't thinking with my mind. And if you weren't thinking with my mind, then you don't abide in me, and I don't abide in you. Like Sheldon Van Auken talks about this in A Severe Mercy, how he and Davy became hypersensitized to each other's interior states, such that she would like look at the lintel, and he would know that she meant for him to light the candles to create some ambiance for their evening party. But as a result of which, when they fell out of mind, you know, the offense was more acute. So it's like as we become closer to each other, as we become vulnerable, in turn, we become more capable or capacitated to, in fact, hurt each other. So it's like in friendship, you hand each other the means whereby to wound, but you entrust that person with those means whereby to wound, cognizant of the fact that they will never be deployed in that way. But that's actually the terms of healing, of corporate healing. It's like, I need to afford you the capability to hurt me if you're going to get in and cauterize the wound at its depth. And so then when you find that that gesture has been taken advantage of, even if only slightly, this light is more significant. And so I think that then when you experience that in the profundity of your own person, that you are, in fact, at war with your own members. It's a kind of, like, experience of just devastation, existential devastation. You know, you can quote with St. Paul, like, who will deliver me from this body? Because it's not going to be me, because I've just proven myself ill-fit to the task. And so I think it's like that kind of primordial scream that wells up in anger against God as the provider of the conditions,
yeah,
if nothing more.
As you're describing the agony of something as simple as I forgot from a friend, I'm curious about whether we could use our, capacity to get angry at someone or a capacity to be wounded by someone actually as a measure for the health of the friendship or the depth of the friendship. I have several times taught Nicomachean Ethics and Aristotle's division of friendship. Just it's really fascinating and an endless well, but it always seems to get reduced, at least on the initial read of, do I have any friends that are not merely friends of pleasure? So for those of you who are not familiar with this, Aristotle and then Thomas Fallingham distinguishes friendship. So he says there is such a thing as just friendship in general. So friends who wish each other well, are pleased and pained alike, and love each other in that respect, pleased and pained alike in that respect in which they love each other. So that's true of all kinds of friendship, but some friends love each other and are pleased and pained alike only with respect to, pleasures. Like the reason why they are together is simply because I find you pleasant and you find me pleasant. And it doesn't go beyond that. And then you can have a friend of utility, which is I hang around you because you're useful to me. Even if you're not very pleasant, you're useful and I'm useful to you. And then lastly, perfect friendship is I hang around you and you hang around me because we both want the same thing, namely virtue. We want for each other what each of us wants for ourselves. And that's not merely a pleasant life or an efficient life, but a good life with every, no matter what. Seems to me that only that the height, that the people who'd be most capable of anger and the people that could be most wounded are those who have a perfect friendship. And that, does that check out for you?
Yeah, because I think I buffer myself, speaking in general theoretically, I think I buffer myself existentially from those whom I know I cannot love and I cannot trust wholly and entirely, because it's like, I'll only share secrets with those whom I know will not betray them. Because if I know that secrets are part of the commerce of your influence, then I know that in sharing them, I will be used, right? And so I'm not going to give you anything by which I can be hurt, because that would be foolish of me, all right? So I'm going to create a space in that relationship and a certain reserve in that relationship such that I cannot permit myself, or I do not permit myself, to be wounded.
That seems, on the one hand, reasonable, but also
sad.
Very sad, because you could have a situation where someone you look around and you say, I don't want to be wounded. I don't have any friends of, perfect virtue. I might have a lot of friends of pleasure, but with none of them, can I really give vent to whatever anger might be in me? On the one hand, these friends aren't making me angrier, but on the other hand, I don't have, anyone who can help me, as it were, metabolize the anger that's here.
Yeah.
So that's a cultural commentary, but charging back to ancient culture as well, probably.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.